Commit it to memory. Family didn't, right? It's the tips of five fingers. I put them vertically one above the other for a definite reason. I had two requests this week by two disconnected persons. I mean disconnected in the gross physical world, because you can't be disconnected in the continuum of sentient power. And funnily enough, they both have the same meaning. One was a request to talk about mediation, and the other was a request to talk about Christ's body. I want you again to focus on this and notice that we have a middle one of five there. Did you notice that? Not you, I don't expect you to notice. The middle one of five. Now we're talking about mediation. If you hold your hand like an animal, with your middle finger first, being the head, can you do that? Can you make an animal like this? Four legs and the head. Your middle finger is the head. I'm going to put the signs in here. Sign of closure, a dot there, primordial dot. And then I'm going to put at the bottom a sign for the earth, and in between a sign for the sun. Now there's a very peculiar thing about this question of mediation. Mediation is providing a middle between two extremes. Now the extremes that we're going to discuss are extremes that we know about very thoroughly in experience. The extremes are order and chaos. Do you remember the dots at the bottom of this diagram? They represent a primordial chaos. A lot of points without coordination, without organization. And at the top there was a point in the middle of a circle. That implies some kind of placing, deliberate placing, a principle of order. And yet, funnily enough, the same sign is used for the symbol of the sun. Now imagine what it would be like if we had no bodies at all, but we nevertheless had a kind of presence, a kind of being, but not focused on a body. What would it be like? Zoe, stand up and demonstrate. Where is she? You're there. Funny, I thought it looked like you when I came in. Now, Zoe is born in the sign of what? She's born in the fishy sign. And fish symbolize emotion, the speed of emotion. I want you to imagine a cosmic ocean, and this ocean can feel itself. And when it moves, that movement is an emotion. But imagine there are no bodies in the ocean. What kind of ocean is it? It's an emotion, body, which is a nobody. To be a real body, you must have a perimeter. You must have a binding line around you to hold you in to a sacred place so that you can actually look at yourself. You are not a self unless you have a circumscribing line. You know the conservation of energy law in the universe, that all phenomena, material or otherwise, are energy behaviors. The energy is simply the way an infinite field works. A field of power. When that power moves, moves always by positing a point of initiation. That's the meaning of the point in the top circle, initiation. You have a circle to symbolize a zone of focus. You have to focus consciousness. If you don't focus consciousness, what does it do? You all go to bed at night, presumably, sometime, and you defocus your mind by closing your eyes, shutting down on the external sense stimuli, and you try to go to sleep. But you find that your mind wanders before you go to sleep. Is that true? Is there somebody with a non-wandering mind before they go to sleep? Hands up. Now it's like, oh, there's a hand with a non-wandering mind. You have a non-wandering mind. You have a non-wandering mind and you go to sleep. Have you? And have you then gone to sleep with a jump or gradually? Immediately. That suggests to me something of what you might have been doing beforehand. I know of only one method of going to sleep immediately. And I'll accept that as a possibility. Now, when you remember it, when you remember that, what is it like to go to sleep immediately? You pass from a waking state where you can see all the furniture in the bedroom, and suddenly you are asleep. And what state are you in when you're asleep? Have you made that peculiar leap? How do you know if you're unconscious? How do you know you lack awareness if you haven't any? You know, that's one of the earliest questions recorded in the world. I know that I slept well, says the yogi when he wakes up. So there is a kind of feeling awareness in a state of deep sleep. This is not objective. This is an awareness. It's an awareness of an awareness. Non-objective. And therefore you can say, last night I slept well. In total unconsciousness. So unconscious does not mean that you're not aware. It simply means that you are not conscious. You haven't got a sharp focus. To be conscious, you must have a focus. It must either be some external body, or a memory of a body in your mind, or the form of a body. Form is idea. Without a focus, either a physical body, or of a mental definition, an idea, you would not be conscious. You would be aware, because you cannot not be aware, because, factually, you are sentient power. You are power that feels itself. Now, between the state of deep, unconscious sleep and external object consciousness, there must be a middle state, mustn't there? Somewhere. That state is the state between full waking consciousness and the deep unconscious. In philosophical terms, if we call the external state the waking state and the unconscious state the state of deep sleep, between it we have a state called dream. Now, the external objective state is called gross objectivity. External gross objectivity. But the deep state of unconsciousness in deep sleep is called causal. Causal, that's very interesting. And the state between those two is called subtle. So you have a gross world, the world of external objects, like the bodies we can see in the room. Now looking around, we see bodies. We can go out and hit them and test them and so on to make sure they are bodies. And we get some kind of tangible experience of them. When we say, lo, Gerhard exists because I throw something at him and it bounces. His body has sufficient density to bounce an object that I throw at him. Can I throw an object at you, Gerhard? Ready? I won't throw it this way, I'll throw it this way. It might twist, though, and go like that one to arrive. So perhaps I'd better throw it that way. Which do you prefer? That way. Right, are you ready? It bounced. Now that bouncing of objects, when they collide, is our only proof that there is a gross external objective world. Because apart from that collision bounce, you are only shapes on my retina. You look around like that, point your eyes, and you'll be aware of shapes, colours, tones. But unless you go out and bounce your fist off the nose of your seen object, you can't guarantee that it is not, in fact, a hallucination. Now, we know that the gross material world, of which we bounce things, by using various technical devices today, like cyclotrons and accelerators and so on, we can actually cause collisions subatomically and shatter the myth of gross materiality as real. And what we find is that the gross material world is simply an energy world with the primordial spinnings of the energy constituting so-called particles. They also oscillate, and therefore they have a wave phenomenon with them. So one scientist, Schrödinger, said, let's call them wavicles, because they behave like waves, they oscillate, and they also behave like particles, they can collide. In the deep unconscious state, unconscious merely means that we have no gross object, tangible, bounceable thing in consciousness. Nevertheless, we are aware, in some mysterious way, of that condition, because we can say, I slept well last night. And if you slept badly, you would know about that too. Badly really means disturbed by partial forms with emotional charges on them. Now, somewhere between these two extremes, the extreme of an unconscious, that is sentient, formless condition, and a gross material, tangible, collision-making condition, there is a subtle condition. And that subtle condition is the dream. Put that clearly in your mind. Hit yourself like that. That's collision possibility. When you get an exercise like that, don't be shy. Don't not do it. It's very important for you to get physical feedback. Do that. Hit yourself so it hurts a bit. Gerhard is very good at hurting himself, and therefore he's very conscious. I hurt myself when I do that, and the tissue there remembers the blow. Now, every time you have been hurt with an experience in a collision situation in the body, the cells of your body remember for you. There was a Muslim on the TV last week who had a corn on his head there, so beating his head on the ground in prayers. And there's a kind of pride about that. If you've got a bigger corn than somebody else, it means you're a better prayer. It's very, very useful because it actually remembers. The hurt bit of you remembers. And it's very important. It remembers the form of the situation. Now, supposing we did away with the gross material world, so we had no bodies that would collide, we would have no evidence that what we actually experienced was really there, that it was not an hallucination. In the subtle world, the world of the dream, we often find that we have forms, but they are vague. And you don't get a kind of collision feeling in the dream, do you? You might be afraid in the dream of a collision, but do you ever make the collision in the dream? It's too vague. There is energy there, but it is not compacted enough. A dream is like this. Now, if we take that motion, doing that, that's like a dream. And it might turn around for a moment and then go away, and turn and go away. A dream is an energy of emotion partially forming itself and passing from one form to another so quickly that it hasn't time to stabilize itself in the same way that a gross material energy system does. When we look in the dream, by practice, on the point of going to sleep, or on the point of waking, we can actually look both ways. We can train ourselves so that we sit right in the middle between the unconscious, formless awareness and the gross external objective awareness. Now, the internal one, in opposition to the external is called objective awareness, then the innermost is called subjective awareness. Now, you know that the word subject means both thrown under, sub, and that's the Akarya root, thrown under, and at the same time it is the knower, the subject who knows. When you say, I know, or we know, or they know, then the subject who knows is thrown under by his own attention to the object. The subject throws himself under the object. He identifies with it. If you look at one of the lights, focus on it. When you focus on it, for the moment you focus, you have subjected, thrown yourself under, subjected yourself to the influence of the light. Now, supposing you don't know that. I saw a man today, and he was feeling very depressed. He came in and said, I'm very depressed. And I said, isn't it funny, you were very depressed this very day last year, because Christmas is coming. Already the shadow of Christmas is coming. Did you know that people tend to get depressed as Christmas threatens to arrive? You think it's because you have to send postcards and buy presents for people you hate? No, it isn't that. It's much deeper. A long time ago, although the priests, astronomers, knew better, the people didn't. When the sun went down, they thought it was going to go down and stay down. And they got very worried in case it didn't come up. And then the priests who knew the true cycle astronomically, for a consideration, offered to pray it up again. Did you know that? And they used to go for 40 days, nights, up into the Arctic Circle, where it rolls around the edge, and watch very carefully from a mountain position, and wait for it to start peeping up a bit higher than the day before. The lowest day is about the 21st of December, isn't it? The day when it obviously begins to climb is the 25th. So that is the birthday of the light, the birthday of the sun god. Whether we talk about Jesus Christ, his birthday, or Zarathustra, the founder of Persian religion, the birthday is the same. It is the day the sun obviously begins to rise again. When the priests saw it climbing, they rushed down the mountains and said to the people, our prayers have succeeded. And everybody cheered up and got drunk. Any excuse will do for getting drunk, of course. They had a big party to celebrate the victory of the sun god. Now, there were men in those days who knew the rules. And there were large crowds of beings who did not. Now, the men who knew the rules were mediators, were they not? Between a knowledge that the people didn't have and the people. They were able to interpret astronomical facts and give an assurance, a security, to the people who didn't know the rules. So we find that the great priest king in the ancient world was the mediator between the ignorant masses of people and a knowledge that is not in the gross material world. Where is the knowledge? It is in the minds of those who know, is it not? But where did they get it from? Not from the people, did they? They got it from a funny thing called observation. It is not surprising that certain peoples, nomadic peoples and agricultural peoples, at night, looking at the sky, began to see that there was a cycle of events, that the planets move in an orderly manner, that the sun appears against a background of stars, and that in the spring the sun will be in a certain position in relation to a certain star shape. It will have entered the first point of arcs. And then you've got your beginning of your year, March. Let's get marching. Think that those men were mediators. They have a large crowd of non-knowers, and there is a wisdom that has been acquired through an intuitive process gained by meditation on the big cycles of nature. What happens on the floor of a factory? Is it not true there has to be somebody who has bothered to study certain rules of human relationships, of labor relationships, of economy, of international relations? So there is a mediator there too. Wherever two people don't understand each other, a third one who studies the rules might be a mediator. So, as mediators vary in capacity and vary in knowledge, we would have to say that we will be forced to consider a very lowest type of mediator who perhaps knows only one thing more than the crowd, and the very highest type of mediator who knows more than any other mediator. That logically follows that if you have mediation between your little finger and your thumb, the middle mediator there has great importance because he mediates between, on your little finger, Mercury, commerce, and on your thumb, free will. He mediates. But between the middle finger and the little finger, you have another finger, a ring finger. And that mediates between commerce and the mediator. He's a sub-mediator. And you have another mediator, your index finger, between the middle finger and the thumb. Now let's look at that and remember that diagram. Look at the fingertips like that, and you have those five circles. And I mark the middle one with the sign of the sun. But funnily enough, in this symbology, the middle finger is marked with the sign of Saturn. Because Saturn means the first manifest form point, creator of time and matter. All right? When we made this shape like an animal, we march along, and this is the head of the animal. The head of the animal is time, consciousness. The consciousness of time mediates between eternity and the physical, material, body, matter. Eternity is formless, not formless like an ignorant man. Formless because it is so bright that it outshines its content, like shining a very, very, very bright light onto a picture printed on white paper. You shine a very bright light. Can you see that picture? No, because the light reflected is too intense and it makes the halation round the pattern on the retina so that the form vanishes in light. Now, eternity is a very, very bright light which outshines all the formal edges. But at the bottom end, there is a dark body, and there it is in the grip of time matter, and it doesn't outshine. Take a black body, it doesn't outshine anything. Now imagine that your body, in the dark, without a light shining on it, can be located by touch, by that possibility of collision. And at the other end of reality, there is your will. And your will itself has no edges. Your will is infinite. And your will is self-illuminating. But the will has thrown down a body of reference. Your physical body is a precipitate of your will, your intention to exist, to create a focus so the consciousness will not wander about. Why shouldn't we let consciousness wander about? Because if we do, it might come across strange, frightening things. You know how you tend to be afraid if you go into a dark room that you've never been in before. You think maybe something's lurking, a black cat with its eyes shut, or a rat, or some terrible, undefined thing may be there, and it may jump on you. And you pray for light. If you've got sufficient money and good wiring in the house, you pay for light. But you actually aim at getting light to remove the fear. Consciousness must be distinguished from the awareness that you have in deep unconscious sleep. In deep unconscious sleep, you are aware that you are a presence to yourself. But you are not conscious. Remember, the SCI in conscious is the same as in scissors, means to cut. It implies that a form has been cut away from another form. So you have a form here, cut, form, cut round it, form, cut round it. Because it's been cut round, you can separate or discriminate forms. So conscious means with cut. The us is from usia, being. With cut. In the state of deep unconsciousness, you have a sentience and awareness, but it isn't cut. And when it's not cut, you can't do anything about it, can you? Because the word do means precisely to differentiate. The D in do and differentiate has exactly the same basic function. When you do something, you divide one thing from another, and that you cannot do in the state of total unconsciousness, that is, pure sentience without any discriminated objects. You can't use it, you can't do anything with it, it is useless. Now, in total opposition to that, you have a gross material body, which you can get hold of like this, and you can do things with it. I switch on again, and then I alter the angle. What's happening to the picture? Is it changing? Yay, verily, it is changing. By manipulating gross material objects, which are only condensed powers, we can induce phenomenal changes deliberately ourselves. Now, I put a question to you. In which state would you rather be? In a state where you can do nothing, and you're merely aware, and what you're aware of is absolute and whole pure sentience, but you can do nothing with it, or a state in which you can manipulate objects like this and change the world. Which do you prefer? There's a well-educated person in the house. Both. Why? Because we said before, in the state of deep unconsciousness, you have absolute form outshone by its own sentience. In other words, it is omniscient. It knows all that could possibly be known, but it's too bright at that level. Whereas at the gross objective level, to put a man on the moon, how many men do we need on Earth? Have you any idea? what magnitude of team there was to put a couple of men on the moon, and what weight of rocket there was to shift those few stones of human weight. Isn't it rather a heavy, gross way of doing things? Really? It's very effective, isn't it, when you get a man on the moon, and he puts a flag up, and because there's no wind, he puts a wire in it to make sure it will show whose flag it is. But it's all terribly gross manipulation, isn't it? And somewhere between gross manipulations and omniscience, which knows exactly what to do without any gross manipulations, there is a middle position. And as we said before, just like in mediation, there is a fellow who knows a bit about it, a little bit more than the crowd, and there's a fellow at the other end who knows all about it. Now, the one that knows all about it in religions is always called the son of the son. Why should he be called the son of the son? Son of my soul, my saviour dear. Why should that be said? Because up there in the sky, 93 million miles away, there is an objective representation of what we're talking about. You also have the same thing in your physical body, in your solar plexus. Why is that plexus called solar? Not lunar. It happens to be the center, the middle, the mediator between the gross external world of bone and muscle and the world of the will that can induce changes immediately. Now think about the sun for a moment. The sun, 93 million miles away, weighing colossal tonnage, pours its body out. Millions of tons of photons leave the sun and they shine through the solar system, and we get a lot of that energy daily falling on the earth, and it is only through that energy falling on the earth that we are alive. If it weren't for the synthesizing of the energy of the sun by plants, there would be no plant world, no animal world, no human world. We are actually, observe, actually sun energy organizing earth matter. Now, where does the sun get its energy from? It gets it from the continuum. And just as in deep sleep, you are unconscious, but you are omniscient. And that omniscience, from the point of view of the waking ego, is no knowledge whatever. So, the condensed sun that we see in the sky is merely the center of reference for invisible infinite light. That invisible infinite light is given a negative name by all the great mystics. It's a non-light, meaning to say it is so bright that if we look at it face to face, we can't see it because it outshines the forms that itself precipitates. But that sun in the sky is mediating between the earth, the gross material earth, and the intelligence of eternity, the field of power which is stretched infinitely through space, has condensed the sun and made of itself a body. And having condensed that body, it presses with tremendous power upon itself. The pressures inside the sun are very, very high. And by means of that pressure, it squirts out from itself. And if you were to take an orange and squeeze it so hard that the juice shot out through the pores, that would be a perfect analogy for it. Tremendous pressure is being put upon the sun. Now imagine the first primordial point. That was the one that we placed at the top of our diagram, represented by the thumb. That first primordial point has the same symbol as the middle one in the diagram there, the sun in the sky. But that same sun is the cause of time. Do we not measure time by days? and by weeks, and by months, and by years. And is it not always in relation to the rotation of the earth around the sun, and the spinning of the sun on its axis, and the travelling of the sun through the masses of the stars? Time is a function of movement, but there would be no movement unless that infinite, eternal, tremendous outshining light were to condense itself and dim itself. When we look at the sun, we see a very bright light, but that light is dim compared with the light we would see if we had to face the power that has condensed itself as the sun. The sun is a mediator between invisible light that's too intense to see and the gross material on Earth, the planetary body. The planetary body is dark, the sun is very bright, but the sun is a step-down transformer. It has taken the invisible power of the infinite and it has been squeezed and made a ball of the sun and squeezed tighter, and it squirts out its force as photons, as light packets, which are caught by the plants and then organized by the same power of the sun into plants, animals, men. So the sun is a great mediator. It's the biggest mediator we can actually see. It mediates between the invisible power of the universe and the gross material effect of that power, the planetary body of the Earth itself. Now, if you look at the sun shows three obvious manifestations: lighting, heating, and an actinic ray that produces chemical changes. It does three things. It enlightens you, it warms you, and it makes you physically. Our bodies are made of captured protons, functions, primordial standing energies with rotating minor energies, electrons around them, and they have been captured by sun energy itself, which is sentient. Now imagine that the little fellow down below who mediates between the boss of a small firm and five employees, he knows a little bit more than they do, but imagine at the other end there is someone who knows all about the whole system, and he has a body too, and his body is the sun. Can you believe that the sun is the body of intelligence? Or does that sound like superstition? The sun is a compressed sentient power. It is a body of intelligence mediating from eternity into time and matter for earth beings. And our intelligence is only sun power, the light of the sun. And our enthusiasm is only the heat of the sun. And our physicality, our chemistry, is only the captured actinic rays of the sun. So we are entirely solar beings on Earth. The question is, do we know we are? Now, we said earlier on that the priests, kings, scientists of the ancient world, who knew that great law and knew the law of the cycle, they knew that the sun would come back, but there were millions of people who didn't. Now, which you prefer? To be a non-knower who gets frightened every time the sun goes down just before Christmas and believes it may never come back? Or would you rather be a knower who knows it will come back? Which would you rather be? You'd rather be a knower. Well, you have to be very careful about that, because if you know something, not only do you know it, but you are responsible for knowing it. You cannot have knowledge without responsibility. If you do know that, you could be a bit cautious about wanting to know. There are people that say, like Lawrence of Arabia said in his film, "I want to be an ordinary man." Do you remember the scene? Now, he wanted to be an ordinary man, not a great hero. A great hero had responsibility. He, in fact, had promised Palestine to the Arabs at the same time that Balfour had promised it to the Jews. both on the authority of the same government. How did he feel about it? Did he not feel responsible to the Arabs to keep his promise? The fact that he knew something made him responsible, and he actually became ill with the responsibility. And he made a lot of enemies because he tried to fulfill his responsibility to his promise regardless of the background politics. You cannot have knowledge without responsibility. So I'm going to put that question to you again. Which would you rather be? An ignorant being with no responsibility, or a fully equipped being with absolute responsibility? I get an immediate spontaneous, oh, I opt for the fully responsible omniscient being. Huh? Or are we ambiguous about it? Can you give 100% vote yes? I prefer omniscience and total responsibility. Or do you get a little bit on guard? Because what does it do? It makes you, of necessity, in a position where you have to apply the law given to you by the Son, in the words of Jesus, inasmuch as you do it to the least of these, you do it to me. That is your responsibility. If you understand that all the bodies in this room are simply modalities of a primordial field of power, and that power is sentient, how do you relate to the other bodies in the room? Are you not absolutely responsible for each other? If you understand what is being said about it, there is an infinite field of sentient power. Power that feels itself, and it has made bodies like this. Body, 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 body. All the bodies belong to it. So when you say my own body, you mean the body I owe to that infinite power. And your plain duty to every other body is to treat that body as you treat your body, in exactly the same way. Now, how do you like that? Can you actually find yourself able to think in that way about other beings? That you treat them all with the same degree of kindness as you do the body you've got most near to you, the one central to your consciousness. When you climb into bed, do you sneak a bit of extra blanket in the winter night? Or do you say, over to you, dear, and leave one leg out in the cold? You see, you can't know without being responsible. So the big mediator is also the man with the big responsibilities, you know. Now, in history, there have been many attempted mediators who tried to mediate between eternity and time, between spirit and matter. And those men have become what we call historically great figures. We had Dina Mahavira, we had Gautama Buddha, we've had Moses, we've had Jesus Christ, we've had Muhammad, all mediators, and many more. Socrates is a great mediator between pure logic and applied logic in the time process. These men are called great only because they were mediators, not for any other reason. Because the people who call them great must be indebted to them for some kind of enlightenment.
How come they all got killed?
For the same reason we've just said. Did you give an unqualified vote for omniscience and total responsibility? Seven?
No.
So if somebody came along and said to you, I tell you that you have no alternative but the assumption of total responsibility, not only for that body, but for every other body in the universe. How do you feel? Please?
Yes.
What the qualification? Fundamental.
You can say that by accepting that, you actually commit yourself to the highest.
Are you married? Are you married?
Yes.
Do you love your wife?
I do.
Do you share her? You do? In every way?
It's
You see? Now the answer is very simple. You draw a line, don't you, somewhere? Yes, don't you? Do you live somewhere? Have you got a car with you? When you sleep in my bed tonight, and I'll go to your home.
Why?
Because we are all modalities of one space-time power field. And I'm sure if you can put up with it, so can I. Yes? You're being as bad as Trevor now, aren't you? She's very good looking, actually. Isn't she, Trevor?
My wife.
Yes. Yeah. I think so, too. Yeah? You see, now you want to know why they kill the prophets, and I'm telling you. And you're drawing lines. And saying it all depends what you mean by goodness and sharing and blah. Doesn't it? Do you know you're a marvelous Pharisee? Do you know that? That was a perfect Pharisaic response. Christ doesn't say, deeply consider whether this person is or is not a beggar in the true sense of the word. What made you say he was upset? Does he say upset? You see what I mean?
No.
Concerned. I'm sorry for the man. You'll turn into a Jew if you're not careful. Isn't that funny? Already.
All right, yes,
please. See? It's about to change religions to get out of the jam.
Not really.
Fundamentally, he'd been lying like a Marano in Spain. Wouldn't you, dear?
You make a
Yeah. You wouldn't really change, would you?
Not really.
No, you'd soon be 100% pro Trevor.
Well, if by that you mean representative of all the sentient
Yes. It's just what I mean.
Great.
And so is everybody else. So we might as well save three little dollars in a tub. Now you want to know why the prophets are stoned and why Christ is crucified? The answer is that people would have to become responsible for each other in a way that they are not prepared to be responsible. Is that true or not?
Yes. Well, I was thinking about Akhenaten and relating him to the sermon, the fact that he sees that there is a unique principle at work. And then as soon as he becomes weak, he's smashed, and everything else to do with him is smashed. But it's still there. It's not the same as this.
Where did he get the idea from? He got it from his mother. You know his mother was a Syrian sandwich, but... And have you examined the portraits of Akhenaten? Don't they look like what they are? Mother's darling. Do you remember? He's rather nice and a bit hippie, isn't he? If his mother hadn't have been a Syrian sun worshipper, there wouldn't have been the great hymn to the sun of Akhenaten, would there? No. And he opposed all the priests, didn't he? And as soon as he was out of the way, they put back the old religion. So although he had a good idea, it doesn't matter where he got it from, but he had an idea, a monotheistic idea, let's worship the sun. But did he mean that orb in the sky? Or did he mean the orb in the sky plus its radiation? Shu, atom, shu. The atom, the sun disk, and the radiation, the shu, from it. Or did he include the invisible that condensed itself as the sun before it became shu? Like ptah, atom, shu, the Trinity. Did he mean that? History doesn't say, does it?
Well, I have a feeling that he probably did. It doesn't say Amun Prince was not
a prince
of him.
Right.
He thought he got a better idea.
So you said it again. Because he had, as far as the priests were concerned, a better idea, they were ready to kill him and cross his name off the monuments after death. So that is why, as soon as a person assumes full responsibility for himself, he assumes responsibility for his will and for his relation with every other will, doesn't he? Can he treat other beings as bodies of collision and without persons, as objective its, and not as he's and she's?
No.
No. But in fact, do we like to have to consider each other's welfare as much as we consider our own? Before you go to sleep, do you lie there thinking, what good can I do for all the people I know? And find that you've fallen asleep before you got round to you? In practice. That's part of the dialect. You probably don't want help in this offer to you. Why not? When you offer the help, they're too lazy to do something about it. Suppose somebody offers you help because they've got a good objective observation about you. Do you jump at it and say, thank you very much, I will now modify? Or do you have to consider it? And what would determine that? Wouldn't it be that on occasions of previous advice you had attained some benefit in one case and not in another? So wouldn't you really be opting for benefits? You're not talking about the person that gives the advice. You're talking about the benefits that accrue from taking it. What are we up against again? Primal egotism, aren't we? And where did that come from? It came from that infinite field of power which vibrates like that everywhere. And everywhere it goes like that, it posits a point. And that point is the nucleus of an individual. There's another Hebrew saying that says the crown of God is to God as an earth is to man. What does that mean? The primordial point that came in the infinite went round like that. And it marked a circle. It grabbed it. It crowned it. Kraon, create one's own. And it made that primordial point, which is our big universe, and then inside it, it made a lot of little points, which we are. Now, it is interesting that all traditions in major religions say this: the sun is the center of sacrifice. What does it mean? Because the infinite committed itself to become finite at that point. Where the sun is that we see in the sky, is it not true that colossal mass of energy has condensed itself there and is squeezing itself there to make rays of light come out? Now, if power is sentient, how does the sun feel when it grips itself tightly and shines with all its might to give life to people on earth? Is it sacrificial or not? Did you ever think that the sun is a great big being in the sky sacrificing itself It has a body, the sun's body, which you see. If you go near it with probes today, you'll find you can collide from it. It really is there. And it is hurting itself by the intensity of its squeezing to make that light come out that gives life to beings on earth. So essentially, the sun center is a center of sacrifice. And what has it got? Heat, light, and activity. Intelligence, enthusiasm, and the will to make bodies. Those three. And to make sure that everybody gets a bit of this, it is stuck there in space, immobilized in the middle of a planetary system, isn't it? And all the planets go around it and derive their stability from it. Is it not a crucified God? That sound? Isn't that what Akhenaten meant to us? And so he has the sun orb with the rays coming out, and on the end of each little ray there's a hand
giving an
ankh. And an ankh is the crux ansata. It is a loop on top of a letter T, isn't it? And if you'd written O-T. Well, what does he mean, that crux ansata? The loop means woman, and the T means man. And it means that when you hold the ankh, woman is above man. So if you are to observe the law of life of the sun, are you not saying that a man's duty is to treat a woman as a being superior to himself? How do you like that? You have a treasure in the house. Do you treat it like a treasure? Do you dust it? Polish it? Make sure it doesn't get knocked? No, you don't remember all the time. Nevertheless, that is true, isn't it? That the woman is over the man. And what does the loop represent? An O. Yes? Isn't that O, zero? Isn't that the same thing as the invisible, infinite power which has condensed the sun as a visible body? Now, men, let's have a vote. Do you really believe that women are superior beings to men? Did that make the back of your... The place will fill up with Pharisees in 1 second flat. Pharisee means a rationalist. Do you believe, O men, that women are absolutely your superiors in every way? Always, dear. No? You do. Good for each other. And I know that you mean it. Yeah. Just like I know that Gerhard, who says no, has got a lot of mental reservations, you know, to say. The fact is that if women didn't exist, men would not be under trial, would they? Is there anything except woman as a trial to man? Right? When there are no women, don't men get together and sing 10 green bottles cheerfully? No, they really are superior, absolutely. And to make sure that we were not blinded by their innate omniscience, God has put with them a bad habit. That's your mental reservation. Yeah. But without that bad habit, which is called manipulation of this, men could not improve. So they have to be totally forgiven for all the brilliant, illuminating remarks they make with that most unruly member. The tongue is an unruly member, isn't it? So if you can find two unruly members, you'd have to say they're analogues of one of the other, wouldn't you? Yeah? But any man that has to deal with a woman has got an unruly member. She's really a personification of the tongue, is she not? The word tongue is interesting. It means the sound of goo. Tone goo. Now goo is absolute unmitigated appetite. What is the function of man in the presence of that which is so like the absolute that you could not distinguish it from the absolute except in one respect? The absolute is eternally invisible and will remain so. And its representative is visible and tangible in the time process in bed. And what does that require of a man that understands it? Yes. True? And who is he laughing at? Her or him or the situation? Or the big comedian God? No. The man that designed it. Well, because man means evaluator. God the Father. The supreme evaluator who designed this marvelous system of men getting together in shorts, in potholes, on mountain tops, on yachts, on moons, and ladies who call them into dinner.
Are you saying that woman is the mediator
between God and man? Oh, I was wondering if anybody was going to see that one. Woman is a mediator between God and man. What does that say about Jesus? It says that he was as much woman as he was man. And he describes the condition of those beings in heaven as hermaphrodites, doesn't he? Neither male nor female. There are three polarizations. Christ is a being not yet separated into man and woman, but the components of man and woman are inside him, and the components of man and woman are inside every human being. But the kind of society that we've had says to men, be ashamed of your woman half, and to woman, treat man as a being who treats you as if you are a shameful object. Can somebody say that again? Now, how would you like, I appeal to you fellows again, how would you like to be a woman who knows that a man is ashamed of knowing her? Bloody awful, says Gerhard. Yes. How would you like to be a being tied to another being who is ashamed of being tied to you and associates with you for only one reason? He can't help it. He's driven by biological forces. And he's terribly ashamed of it, and when he goes in the pub, he always runs it down, doesn't he? And women know this, don't they? So how do they treat the men that are ashamed of them? Shamefully. That's retaliation. Most of the work I've done in the last 60 years has been trying to persuade ladies not to treat their husbands shamefully, reactively, but only deliberately as an act of free will. Now look at this fact. You have in your economy a solar plexus. It's a special kind of brain. It's not like your forebrain. Your forebrain is a low mediator. It mediates between the external gross object and other information in your brain via your sense organs. But your solar plexus is another brain, very, very much older than this brain in the head. And this solar plexus brain mediates between you and spirit. Where do you feel uncomfortable if you do an unethical act? In the solar plexus. Right? There is a voice there that says you are dropping clangers. It's a very quiet voice. And it just says it quietly, and if you ignore it, you say, okay. I'll remind you later when you're flat on the ground. It won't push you, but it will remind you. What does it cost you in terms of physical suffering? Just like the sun is up there, squeezing itself to radiate photons to the earth, your solar plexus is doing the same thing to you. Every time you do something wrong, it goes like that, and it grips you. Very much. You can kill yourself with what is called remorse, can't you? You know what remorse means? Biting back. You bite back at you because you know you've done it. How do you know you've done it? Because your solar plexus is the same function in you that the sun in the sky is in relation to infinite energy of that power field. So it bites you. Every time you don't do something, a sacrificial deed, that you might do, it bites you. If you're very sensitive, you can feel it biting you. And you can also feel it biting other people. How do you feel if you see somebody that you, say, somebody you love, is making a crass error which will ruin their life? How do you feel for them? Anxious. Every mother knows that one, doesn't she? And even fathers know a bit about it, don't they? When they see a child making a fundamentally wrong choice, which is going to spoil the whole development of their life, where do they feel it? They feel it in the same place. And what they do with it is say, it is my fault for not training this creature better. There's remorse, backbiting. You could say the whole universe, as we know it in its fallen state, is a universe of remorse, of continuous biting oneself for errors made, of omission, commission, the things we don't do that we might, the things we do do that would be better not to do. The solar plexus mediates between the field of power which made your body and your waking consciousness brain.
Why do we have this for people for whom we're not directly responsible?
Because you are directly responsible, actually.
In an overall way.
In an overall way. And you know it in the depths of your being. And it's only through family separation, racial separation, national separation, that you pretend that you are not responsible for what is happening in Ethiopia or Bangladesh or China. You see, what happens, because we're so busy with our private purposes, we haven't time to consider the miseries of other people, because we have our own personal private misery pressing on us immediately. But that doesn't make it any more important, does it, than the miseries pressing on other people? A friend of mine in South America says, it is a great pity that we cannot do for the Indians what would be good for them, because if we improve their housing conditions, the next step will be they are our rivals in business. Our hands are tied, he says. Millionaire organization, our hands are tied, because we could expend a lot of money to improve the housing conditions on those Indians, the natives. But if we do, is it not true, knowing about human nature, if we give them the education and the housing and the food, won't they get stronger? Won't they want to figure in the government? Won't some of them show business talents? Won't there be a rivalry created there? Now, can you guess what he did? Because he was pressed with remorse. If he'd have given a few million pounds away within the situation in South America where he was, to improve the conditions, he would have created immediately some rivals for his own business, wouldn't he? But remorse bit him, he had to do something, so do you know what he did? Come on, let's see how your brain works. Built a church? They've already got plenty of them. Gave it away to whom? No, India. You see, he went on a special tour of India, looking for a situation like the one in South America, to give it to them.
But he couldn't give it to them. He said he couldn't improve the lot, but he couldn't have to do it. That was his alternative.
Well, he couldn't improve them in his own country without making rivals to his own position of authority. So he goes to another country and gives them the problem of dealing with rivals to them. And at the same time, he gets a knighthood for giving away so much money. Yeah? And that's what we call man, the evaluator, the counter. Now, do you know why? Do you know why he didn't feel better for it? He could not actually find anybody in India in a sufficiently responsible position to accept the money. Do you know why, what they told him? If we clear up the ghetto that you give this money for, the news will fly right through India, and in other impoverished places they will migrate and build a bigger ghetto around the one you just reformed. Our rivals will increase. They knew about it, fancy that. Indian businessmen knew just as much as South American businessmen about the possible danger of creating rivals by helping people to get strong. You know, strengthened the Europeans and made them into imperialists. Can you guess what a little simple thing it was? The introduction into Europe of spices. Could you believe that? Spices. Why was that? Because, you know, when you store things for winter eating and you smoke your meat and you do all kind of funny things to keep it, you batter it senseless, don't you? Doesn't it taste like rag or something? And without spices you couldn't eat it. But when they found the spices in the East, and brought them in, didn't the appetite go up? You can eat a lot more rubbish with spice on it. And then you find you're getting big. And then when you do that, you get strong, you get ambitious. And you go out and build an empire. Isn't that funny? Because of spice. A little thing, isn't it, spice? Have you looked at those little peppers lurking in your pickle jar? And said, those damn things allow me to eat things I wouldn't tolerate without. And I can get a bigger body and more weight and greater strength and then become big. And that's a serious problem, isn't it? You see, the more we know, the more our hands are tied about doing good. What do you feel like when you recognize that total knowledge is total responsibility? Don't you feel immobilized? And don't you thank God that you're as ignorant as you are? Oh Lord, deliver me from wisdom. Yet meanwhile, back at the lounge, some beings have committed themselves to that responsibility. And historically, we had the men I named before, and we have those particularly whose birthdays were fixed by monkish astrologers as the 25th of December, and we call them the great sons of the sun, the invincible son of the invisible God. He is a mediator, and he necessarily is sacrificial. Everybody who commits himself to the full service of the human race is a sacrificial figure. Doesn't he have to come straight and get wise and squeeze himself in order to radiate? Doesn't he wear himself out in the process? Necessarily, sacrifice is the mark of an enlightened being. Now, think about that. What does it mean? That if you become enlightened in that way, you have to make yourself just like the sun in the sky. The sun is an archetypal form, the very, very paradigm, the very type of Savior. A being that brings from infinity into finitude and squeezes the invisible light into visibility, and then immediately antagonizes everybody on earth who does not want this Gigi Muga mutual reciprocal interpenetration of responsibilities. So it's time to kill him, isn't it? As soon as you locate him and can get your hands on him. How do we feel about that?
Well, I feel scared.
Because responsibility is very frightening, because you can make mistakes, you know. What happens to a general that makes a big mistake and we lose 250,000 men? How does he feel? Pleased? Does he like to say the encyclopedia has got me down? A super clot. Because of his public image. But he is a mediator between certain military principles and the private soldier, Tommy Atkins. Oh no. But he's trying to be. Within the limits of his understanding, he tries to be. And then you can.
So only through the breathing can you be stronger to what the people think.
Yes. And yet every finite human being identified with his own condition can only squeeze himself or herself to a certain degree. Not everybody can squeeze themselves as tightly as, say, the great Mahavira, who squeezed himself so tightly he said, "I will not move because I will not stand upon a living being like an insect." And he stood there and a tree grew around him. Yeah? There is a 50-foot-high statue to him, and it shows a vine wound around his leg and around his body. He's been standing still. Rather than harm, he has stood still. In other words, every time you do a sacrificial deed and you see the benefit of that sacrificial deed, you are glad that you did it. Now the word sacrifice is made of two words, one meaning secret and the other meaning to do. And what is their secret about what the son is doing? It's quite simple. The astronomers think it's just something in space, don't they? Do the astronomers think it's a representative of the invisible God? Or do they think it's a simple mass of incandescent gas? So, it is a secret deed, isn't it? They don't know what it's doing. But it really is doing that. It is squeezing itself intelligently to radiate life onto the earth so that astronomers who don't believe it can live. Isn't that kind? It actually shines on astronomers who are atheists. That's a lovely sacrifice, isn't it? Aren't all the best sacrifices like that? That you sacrifice, that is, you have a secret intent behind what you're doing, and the person who gets the benefit of your sacrifice hasn't seen beyond you and has interpreted your sacrifice as a very much lower order than it really is. But the benefit is invisible. Well, that's visible.
But there can be an invisible benefit to them, isn't
that? That they don't know about. That's part of the sacrifice.
Again, this is mistake.
Yes.
Are you hinting at mercy?
On the general?
Well, presumably the general is part of the continuum and the visible.
Yes.
How is he to reconcile with himself with error? Because we can't really do it in the life of the thing, not in the battle.
No.
And he has to live with that remembrance. And it is a burden other than a metaphysical one, really, because he can't escape from it.
In solar plexus tells. He's ego about it. Now, when Montgomery, immediately after the war, gave his first lectures at the university, it was about pride. The danger of pride to military leaders. Somehow, he's got to cure that terrible pride that men tend to have when they're in charge of large armies of inferior beings. Does a good general think that his men are really inferior beings? No. He knows they're doing a job at a lower level than his. Lower, not in any ultimate sense, but lower in the sense that he's at the center and they're around him to the periphery of their army, where up means towards the center and down means away from the center, doesn't it? So inferior is amusing, because the inferior being is on the perimeter, and the superior being is on the center, in this time world. But the exact opposite is true in the spirit world, isn't it? Because inferior means bearing within, and superior means superficial. So in the real sense, internally, insofar as you bear upon your innermost center, where your unconscious omniscience is, you look from outside like an inferior. And if you show off with lots of performance on the outside, you look superior, but you are to that degree superficial. So the values of the material world and the spiritual world are exactly opposite. And there you have that orb. Not far away from Christmas, actually, is it? And the nights are already growing longer. The days are growing shorter. And it is a fact that if that sun were mysteriously to stop radiating, we would all die. And so would every other life on the earth. Every life on this earth is dependent on that soul of sacrifice. And in the same way, every human intelligence in the realm of tradition and education is dependent on those human beings who recognize the sacrifice of the sun and duplicate it. So when Gautama decides that he will copy the cycle on the heavens and teach this cycle, doesn't he actually put himself on tour teaching people who don't know about it? And doesn't he die at 8 years of age, tortured because he'd been poisoned? A sacrificial figure. But if you damage the sacrifice, what happens to you? Necessarily, if you try to avoid the sacrifices that are proper for you to make, you perish. You begin to corrupt and disintegrate on the inside because you're fed up with sacrifice and you think it's unprofitable to you. But the moment you think that sacrifice is unprofitable, you start to disintegrate. Only the sacrificial life is worth having. And the sun is our standing proof of that fact. And in history, all the great ethical philosophers that ever tried to produce the human scheme of human evolution, they're all sacrificial figures. And in turn, each one, century after century, is criticized and taken to pieces and reduced to nothing by the successors. To destroy any tendency to egotism there might be in him. No, you are not sacrificed unless you yourself make a secret deed. It isn't sacrifice when a man kills a bull from the bull's point of view, is it? The bull has simply been killed. That's no sacrifice. The bull didn't say, "I sacrificed myself," did it? Now, who is doing the sacrifice there? Sacrifice means seeker doing. Is it the disintegrating person who is doing the sacrifice, or is it the universe secretly taking him to pieces? So there's no virtue to the individual who disintegrates. So you'd better choose to sacrifice yourself, because you will be taken to pieces if you don't. Well, that depends whether he can assemble himself enough to learn the lesson. If he dubs his sacrifice everywhere, he can't integrate himself, can he? He can't learn the lesson if he don't integrate. Psychopathology, all the neuroses and psychoses, are nothing but the logical result of dubbing sacrifice, dubbing responsibility.
Yes, but what those forces that bring them together then ultimately force them to face the fact.
Why should they?
Just the pile of evidence that will accrue.
That's what we call a pious hope, you see. It may be true and it may not. It doesn't rest within the hands of a disintegrated individual, does it?
Certainly not.
No. So you're back again to sacrifice. In order to rescue that disintegrated individual, a non-disintegrated individual has to go and look for the bits and put them together again. That makes you terribly indebted, doesn't it? You let yourself disintegrated, somebody else has to come and put you back together again. How do you feel about that? You let yourself fall about through shirking responsibility, you fall into minute fragments, somebody else picks them up, puts them back together again, says, "There you are, I give you yourself." How do you feel about that? Grim. Whichever way you look at it, finally, self-sacrifice is the only comfortable sacrifice there is. So when we're talking about industry, about the relation between workers and bosses, there has to be a mediator. And he must understand the meaning of sacrifice. He can't afford to have a pride that is injured, can he? The virtue of the son is that it gives and gives and gives. The vice of the son is that he's proud to be able to give. And on that little note, we will retire a little.